This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The 1993 Battle of Mogadishu, depicted in the Academy Award-winning movie Black Hawk Down, was today's guest's first combat mission. Seymour native Tom Satterlee served a total of 25 years in the United States Army, 20 of those years in the elite Tier 1 unit Delta Force until his retirement. He served in some of the most critical and high-profile missions of the last three decades. He's also the co-founder of the All Secure Foundation, which helps special operations warriors and their families heal from the war wounds we can't see, PTSD, anxiety, depression, and so on. He's out with a new book that's part true life thriller and part deep introspection. The book is called All Secure, A Delta Force Operator's Fight to Survive on the Battlefield and the Home Front. Retired Command Sergeant Major Tom Satterlee, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. I really appreciate that.
We're also joined by your wife, Jen, who co-founded the All Secure Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Tom, I want to focus eventually on the work that you do to help veterans and their families, but your story is a fascinating one. I would think that for a lot of people, and we're certainly not all soldiers, but even for some who have served, to have that infamous Battle of Mogadishu in Somalia in 1993 as your first combat mission, that would shake anybody up, to say the least. If we can, I'd like to go back to how you felt right after that. Obviously, you stuck with it and continued to serve for a total of 25 years. But did that first combat experience make you think twice in any way?
Yes, it really did. It was up to 3 October. It was one of those, this is what combat is. You know, you go out, you mess with the bad guys, you come home, you high five and tell stories. And then you start losing friends. And it just so happened that 3 October we lost a lot of friends, a lot of wounded and lost a lot of friends. And so the moment that it hit me was when we were back on base in Mogadishu. And I still hadn't found the rest of the convoy. It was just two Humvees that made it back to the air base. And we drove by probably about 10 bodies lying on the street, covered up with different blankets and ponchos and poncho liners. And I could tell between the boots who were unit members and who were Rangers. And it sunk in that night that it cost a lot of lives on our side as well, that I didn't necessarily consider in that house for that entire 18 hours. So it hit me as anger. It hit me as anger, and it made me want revenge. And so it kind of strengthened my resolve to stick with it and stay in and exact as much revenge as I could from any bad guy in the world that wanted some. And so I just shed my empathy. I shed compassion. I didn't take note that this is what I'm going to do. This is what happened. And I just trained harder to do better next time to stop that from happening.
Do you think that you, being the person you are now, would react to that in a different way? And if so, would that have shaped your life to come?
I think I'm closer to who I am now than before it started.
Really?
And then that's when it kind of shook me and changed. That night, my switch flipped. I think, and Jen could break it down with a parasympathetic nervous system better than me, but basically, that night when I thought I was going to die, I knew I was going to die. I just kind of gave up. And everything changed for me that night. And so the rest of my life, until somebody pointed it out, wasn't the way to live. You know, I was just driven to do my job as best I could and throw everything else aside and go exact revenge on the enemy or take out the nation's, you know, enemies whenever asked to. And so I look back now and I realize what destruction I was causing myself, but we all go through that. We all do that. And so it was kind of like a tribe of people all destroying themselves together, but doing a good job at work, you know, and meanwhile, our lives around us are all falling down, but we didn't care. It was all about work.
I mean, is that an essential part of the job? Or do you think now, knowing what you know, that this sort of work can be done without that mindset that is, in retrospect, so destructive?
I thought that when we started this foundation early on. I think we're finding out now that even CEOs, they have family issues. They go home. They're driven. They're at the top of an organization. They're responsible for a lot of people's lives, a lot of business. It's stressful. Flash forward combat, same thing. whether you're a private or a general or a CEO of a company, or you work in the mailroom and you just started, when you go home, you still have a spouse and a family you have to deal with and life's issues. And that's where we all fall apart. We're good at our jobs. But when we go home, we take everything out on our spouses, our family, our anger, because we're most comfortable there. Then you go back to work and everybody has the same face. You know, I'm normal. How are you? Yeah, normal too. Okay, good to go. And then you go home and you fall apart again. When you hit retirement, there's no more tribe other than your family. And you think back, you know, everybody tells you those stories along the way. Nobody lying on their deathbed says, I wish I would have worked more, you know, or, you know, we all look back and wish we had spent more time with our fathers or you know, our spouses or our children. And now they're grown up and gone and we complain about it, but yet we repeat it over and over again. So we wanted to try to teach them that, yes, you're going to go through this and it's going to destroy you and it's going to be horrible, but keep this in the back of your mind along the way. Get help. Talk about it. Don't bottle it up so it's not piling on the entire time. Eat that sandwich one piece of meat at a time. Don't just stack it up and then try to shove it in your mouth all at one time, because it's difficult. You still have to eat and you're going to eat it all. So eat it a little at a time.
I want to talk a little more about the Battle of Mogadishu. What did you think of the depiction in Black Hawk Down?
I watched it once.
Was
back,
that enough?
Back when it first came out, we had a screening with everyone that was there, with some actors and the director and producer and things. And I remember it being laughing at people with my friends, you know, all hiding things. I didn't look at that movie as an emotional aspect. I looked at it as a another war movie. I wasn't in it kind of thing. And did that really even happen? Tried to watch it several years back, and most recently, a couple months ago, maybe. I can't do it. I break down. Now that I've opened up myself to feelings and emotions again, I break down a little more often these days, which is good. I think I'm shedding all that poison I've had all the years piled inside me. But the depiction, it captures the chaos, but I was learning things watching that as well. You know, when you go to combat, you put on two toilet paper tubes over your eyes, walk around, because that's all you see at that time. And you're so focused on what you're doing, you don't see left and right of you, and your buddy doesn't see what you're doing. So two people can be staring at the same thing and then tell the story seconds later, and they're different. So I was learning. My friends were learning. Like, who did that? Where'd that happen? And did that really happen? You know, was that just thrown in there? Because it is a movie. And it captured the chaos. It captured the fear. But since I haven't seen it since then, and back then I was pretty screwed up, I don't know. I might have a different look at it nowadays. But I get to the scenes where the convoy scenes and they're moving in and the first person gets shot and I start to break down, because it all becomes so real to me that I just can't watch it again.
Do you think you ever could?
I keep trying, which is what we do in life. You know, we try, we fail, we get back up and do it again. I don't know if it would be cathartic or if I just keep going until it all comes out. I don't know if that's really how it all works, but I'll keep trying to watch it just to if it helps somebody and I can describe something differently or better in it, then I'll make it happen. But it's still tough.
You've had a decorated career since then, 64 medals and ribbons, 5 bronze stars among them. You've been involved with big, high-profile missions, including Operation Red Dawn, which led to the capture of Saddam Hussein. The book details a lot of these missions. Speaking of catharsis, was it cathartic to write them, or did it bring back too much in some cases?
Both.
Both.
It was both. It was very tough. Working with the co-author, Steve Jackson, he did such a great job of packaging it, sending it back, and then I would remember more, because I've forgotten a lot, and I continue to forget things, which is sad or good. I don't know which is really good, but it jostled a lot of my memories. And then he spoke to some other friends of mine, which gave me a whole other side to things. He spoke to my sister, which gave me a whole other point of view of my, you know, first divorce. I'm like, oh, I never knew that all these years. I thought so-and-so came and helped her clean my house out and move away. So it helped me kind of relook at my life and realize what I'd done and where I've been. And what did we just do recently where I just read through another short? Oh, I read a blog or a little piece that Jen wrote about our foundation and what we do. And as I read it and I read the numbers that she was posting, you know, I start crying. I'm like, yeah, we do that. I don't even consider it when we just do what we do, and I never really put it into words or thought what it's doing. But when she's talking about how we're helping all the spouses and the veterans, and I read some things that people have written in, and that I'm so busy I don't read those. I brush through some of them, but she packaged some up together, and I start crying like, wow, we're doing this, you know. So it's very cathartic to get those stories out. It is tough. It brings up emotions, but that's what we have to. The emotions are there for a reason. They're to help you heal. They're to help you get over what you've been through. And so when we suppress them, we get worse. And it's try to tell a bunch of macho warriors that, right? So my wife pushes me out there, and we got out on the dance floor first, and people are starting to follow. So pretty soon we're going to have a pretty big party, and everybody will be out there together healing and finding another path to happiness, hopefully.
Looking back on the writing, which stories were you particularly proud of when it came to how they went down on the page? Things that you were surprised that you remembered and could articulate?
You know, one thing that made me the most proud of the book was when the co-author, when he spoke to some of my friends about missions and about my leadership. I've never felt good enough. I've never felt I should be where I was. I never felt I deserved to be in the room with the men I was in. So I was always working to be better and always had that feeling of unworthiness. So it destroyed me as well along the way. And it drove me to do better. But hearing what some of the men said about my leadership and my calming voice over the radio and chaos and how it helped them in combat brought me to tears again, because I've never considered the fact that I was a good enough leader or appreciated. And so some of those stories about Halloween night that went down and hearing about, you know, my friends reading it and calling me or texting me saying, it was your voice over the radio that night. Thank goodness it wasn't the other guy that we ended up letting go, because he did my job, and I ended up being on the radio, and they heard my voice, and it helped them keep going with all the chaos. Same thing when we had our Black Hawk Down incident in southern Baghdad. I'm thinking, here we go again with Somalia. It's all repetitive. It's happening again. And some of the men that were there were like, you were the one that had the experience, that long-term firefight experience that kept everybody going. And I never knew that. I never knew that till I wrote that and then heard that. So that helps me a little bit with my own personal issues, that I don't feel good enough or worthy enough. To hear that my work and what I'm doing is helping people. So
we're speaking with retired Command Sergeant Major Tom Satterlee and his wife Jen about the new book, All Secure. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to today's show, I want to tell you about our last show. We end every week with the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on the biggest state headlines of the week. We were updated on the disciplinary process with Attorney General Curtis Hill. We heard impeachment commentary from Senators Mike Braun and Todd Young, and Lilly's plans for discounted insulin. You can hear that and all our shows with our podcast. Back now to our conversation with retired Command Sergeant Major and Seymour native Tom Satterlee and his wife Jen on his new book, All Secure, a memoir of his time in the U.S. Army's Elite Delta Force Special Operations Unit.
And on the flip side, what were the ones that were harder to relive, maybe even hard to recall because of the mental trauma you underwent?
Again, some of those are the same stories. You know, the Black Hawk Down incident, a really good friend of mine got blown up, and the medic ran in and told me about it, and I just had to, literally, I was cussing and telling, you know, get out of my face. I don't care. I don't care. I have 75 other people I have to care about right now, so I can't focus on any one thing. I did care, but you have to just erase it and throw that aside and just focus on what you're doing at the moment and not what you really want to be focusing on. That's your really messed up friend who's in the next room, you know, screaming. But reliving Somalia is always a tough one for me. As far as death and, you know, bad combat scenes happening that, I don't know, you don't even want to see them in movies. It was a different kind of difficulty in Iraq because I'm in charge of people now. Now if someone else gets killed, that's still my fault. And that was worse for me. Recounting some of the stories where I sent men out, and you can tell when I'm some of the stories in Iraq, and it's like, I hadn't had anybody injured yet. I still haven't had anybody injured yet, you know, knock on wood. And then, boom, he gets injured, and it just crushed me that I'm always striving for perfection. And I look back now, it was really a goal for me to attain perfection. Nobody got injured or killed on my watch when I'm deployed. And I was crushed when that happened, not because he was injured at the time, but because it ruined my record, right? And so that crushed me. And then years later or months later, when I think about it, I'm like, it's a human being and he got injured and it destroyed me too. But my first thought was, I really didn't want anybody injured ever. And that's a silly thing to hope for, you know? That kind of perfection gets you somewhere, but it also destroys you along the way.
This book, All Secure, weaves these stories of combat and military life together with the toll that it took on you. It's a very real account of how these situations imprint themselves on a person's psyche. And I can only imagine how difficult it is for a soldier, an elite soldier like yourself, to submit mentally and allow yourself that vulnerability required to let these mental and emotional wounds come to the surface. Is that something that took a lot of effort?
I liken it to a no-jump parachutist in the door. Anybody that freezes in the door getting ready to go out the airplane, somebody's going to put a boot on your butt and kick you out of the airplane or rip your knuckles off because everyone else has to get out. It's not good to stop. And that was me. I was white-knuckling the door frame going out to do this and write this, and Jen's telling me, you have to do this. It's marketing, really, for the foundation. It's not just a book. Don't think of it as a book. You know, I would have never written a book. I would have never spoken up about the unit. We didn't make it about the unit. We made it about what it did to me as a person. So it made it easier. But I was kicking and screaming the entire time about, I'm not going to put my name out there. I'm not going to speak about it. I will be banished to the farthest regions of the world by all my friends. And she's like, well, who do you talk to on a daily basis now anyway? And I thought, yeah, okay, next. She's like, who do you see on a daily basis and whose opinion do you value? And I go, I value all their opinions, but do you want to help people? Yes. Do you value their opinion about that? Not if they don't want to help people. No, I don't, you know? So she made me take a hard look at it and the reality of it, of who we were going to help versus how it would make me feel. And then it became easier and easier. And then the fear just came as, is anyone going to read it and will they like it and will it really help? You know, so there's always fear along the way. There's a theme in this life we live.
I would imagine that one variable that compounds PTSD, and maybe it's a major contributing factor, is just the tamping down of memories and feelings, either as they come to you or as bad things happen, tamping down the emotion, which it sounds like you dealt with for decades.
I did. And I think I did a good job at it. You know, Jen is my last wife, but number four, if we're counting, I threw everything away just for that. And it wasn't because, and, you know, I say that because it sounds patriotic. I threw everything away for the unit, which I did mentally. But really, these people I just tried to spend my life with each time got tired of waiting around for somebody whose focus was elsewhere. You know, another woman, my work. And I didn't care. I seriously did not care. I had zero empathy for anyone. And I blamed each person for their problems. If you're homeless, you should have stayed in school. You know, you should have paid attention. If you have this problem, you shouldn't have done that. You should have thought about it before, and now it brought you here, so you deserve it. Get yourself out of it. And I thought that about everyone, and I didn't understand others' feelings or place my emotions in them or try to put theirs in me and understand their situation at all. I just didn't care. And I was like that for so long. And when you open up and you let those emotions out and when you're in the bottom of that hole and you reach up and someone reaches down and just grabs your hand and it's that easy and your whole life changes, I think of how many people I could have helped along the way, how many people I screwed over by not caring. And so now I don't want to do that again, you know, and all taught to be by my lovely wife because she stuck with me. She didn't give up and I gave her every chance to give up. I mean, I literally gave her every chance to give up, begging her to leave me because I would just screw it up, you know, and then proving it along the way, continually trying to prove myself right that I was going to screw it up. I was trying to fulfill that prophecy that I'd created.
Jen, you're smiling.
She's like a breakthrough.
I mean, I don't know, when I hear that, I can kind of picture it, but was that hard for you, or was there resilience there? Were you just kind of dedicated to reshaping this man?
No, it was difficult. It has been and probably will continue to be the most challenging thing in my life, but the thing that I love the most as well. And, you know, I talk and work with a lot of veteran spouses, a lot of women who are struggling as well. And that kind of, Tom talks about a tribe. And so there's a lot of isolation and post-traumatic stress that exists not only with the veteran, but within the whole household. And so I had a really tough 2 years when I met Tom, trying to figure out what was going on with him. I was scared all the time after I learned about his suicide attempt that, you know, if we got in an argument or something happened that, you know, Tom would attempt it again. So I lived in a lot of fear. I lived in a lot of confusion. I was always searching for answers. I'm kind of a research nerd, so I spent a lot of time on computers and phone calls and calling organizations. And when I started talking to other spouses who felt the same way, who were dealing with things the same way, that's when really everything kind of clicked together. I had been working in special operations a few years, working with SEALs and Green Berets, and the stories were so similar to Tom's that I knew that we had an epidemic in this country that nobody was talking about. So, yeah, it was challenging, but all of it was worth it.
She cares about everyone the same way, though, and she has this den mother kind of, nickname. But she has this understanding of people. She doesn't place judgment, and people know that the moment they start talking to her and they open up. And that's really what started it. I mean, she's the one who really started the whole foundation as well. She's like, we have to do this. She goes, I'm tired of training these people before they go to war. Because they would come to us, and we would train them, and she would video them so they could learn from their mistakes. And we would throw everything we'd seen in combat at them. So these Navy SEALs would come and spend, you know, 10 days to, you know, up to 3 weeks with us in different parts of the United States. And we would show them everything we'd seen overseas, you know, suicide bombers, women that would come in, children, dogs, everything. And they would watch the videos. And then the next iteration would come around 6-8 months later. Hey, where's Bill? Where's Bob? Well, he didn't make it out last time, both of those guys. And she's like, these people are not coming home. I don't want to do this anymore. We have to help them after they get home. You know, it's too empathetic for that kind of job, really. And I didn't need it. I thought that that's what I needed to stay in training. But that's a lot of problems. Guys get out and they go contracting. I'm going to do what I did overseas for more money now. You know, it's about money. And they get over and they realize I'm not with those highly trained guys anymore. I'm with another bunch of contractors that I don't know where they came from. And now we're over here doing the same thing. And they're coming home messed up. And too many people were committing suicide. So she said we have to start a foundation. And we didn't know what to do. We had no clue what we were doing. So I continued to work. She stopped working, started researching for a year and a half, 2 years, really, getting everything together before we asked for money from anyone, before we even said what we were doing other than Facebook and social media. And we figured it out. I mean, she really figured it out. And just tell me what to do and I'll do it. You know, you're doing a good job. Just tell me what to do and I'll do that. And finally, this year, you know, we hold our first couples retreat workshop at Big Cedar, which led to so much more. It's been amazing. So she knows what she's doing. So I think I'll follow her for a while.
Do you still train special ops?
I just gave that up in August.
August of this year.
Yes, I just went full time on the foundation.
But knowing what, I'm sure that the process for this book and also the foundation goes before that.
Right.
So with that in mind, I'm curious, since you do all of this work helping former special ops servicemen and women deal with the mental and emotional trauma of war, was part of the training that you provided preparing those soldiers for that part of it? Or was it all the kind of training that you got?
It was all what I got. They don't want to hear it. They didn't want to hear it. And we started socializing it while we were on target. We were socializing it, but not we're going to bring it to you. But, hey, let's go talk in the corner. And then, oh, by the way, have you met my wife? You know, and so, boom, it starts happening. Now the units are coming to us. We want resiliency training. We want it at the end of our pre-deployment training. And we suggested, yeah, let's do that. Let's bring in the wives. They'll watch your last culmination exercise and watch you do a full, complete hit in the dark. And then we'll start our four-day retreat. That way they get a little taste of what you do at work and the stresses that you're under. And then you can come in and talk about life at home and how to manage it, you know, after your deployment. And they're jumping all over. They love it. So those are all shaping up. So what we're going to get is the Department of Defense will pay for those. And they'll get the same retreat resiliency training before. And that money that they pay us goes to house the same amount of veterans and their spouses that are retired after that need help.
What does that look like? How does someone prepare for that part of it, the resiliency training? I don't think I've ever heard that term before.
Yeah, it's the military term, I'm sure. They keep popping up, and they come up with new ones all the time. And I'll use words, and my wife's like, is that a real word? I'm like, well, I don't know, but I sure use it a lot. I don't know.
But what we're talking about when we say resiliency training, we're talking about overcoming we're talking about mitigating PTSD, or we're talking about recognizing what causes it before you go into the situations?
Recognizing what causes it before you go into the situations, which is what we're doing more recently as well with a Special Forces 300-person class. None of them have been to combat yet.
Except for the instructors.
For the instructors. So you have a room of 300 mix of civil affairs, male, female, civil affairs, psychological operations, psychological warfare, and then you have Green Beret trainees all working together. Half will support the other, well, three quarters will support the quarter. You know, support's always larger. And they'll be deployed together. And so they're hearing it now. And I tell them when I talk to them, I go, I know you're sitting in the chair, you're young, you're motivated, you're studs, you don't care what this old guy has to say. I go, I've been in that seat. I sat in that seat thinking I knew everything. I could conquer the world. Listen to me. You can't. Go out and do your job still. You can be just as good. But just like you come back and clean your weapons and you come back and you work out and you exercise and you worry about your diet, help your mental health. Get out that other poison. You know, there's such a stigma to it that nobody wants to admit to it. I mean, we took out D. We talk about PTS or occupational stress injury, whatever you want to call it. Who cares? If you don't like the name, let's change the name. It's still the same thing. It's biological anyway. We can help fix it. We can counter it. We can mitigate it and manage it. But going in with that seed planted in the back of your mind that, oh, I remember. He talked about this. I'm going to feel this way. It's not so weird to you anymore. Because the things that happened to me, the feelings that I had along the way, I didn't want to share it because I thought it was weird and odd. And now we're finding out that to a person, every single person had the same exact thoughts and fears and worries, except for the ones who won't, you know, I don't have a problem at all. I killed so many people, blah, blah, blah. You're the problem now. I mean, if you're a narcissist, that's fine. But don't tell all the other kids that are listening to you that it's okay and you don't understand why all these wusses are coming out here saying they have PTS and they need help because you're fine. I'm happy for you if it's true, but everybody else I've met, and we've talked to a lot of people, it's not true. It's not natural to take a human life. It's not natural to watch your friend die before his time in your arms or whatever other gory thing you want to think of. It's not natural.
Are there people who think that this sort of approach, resiliency training, things like that, dealing with PTSD before it happens, is there anyone who thinks that that compromises the effectiveness of what soldiers are trying to do?
I'd say that's the cultural shift that we're trying to get into now. Some of the younger generations, when we go to these, like Central Washington University, we talk to these ROTC students, you know, they're different. They're different than the Vietnam veteran, you know. The first Iraq War veterans are different than the global war on terrorism guys. Then the new ones coming in are, you know, society's changing. Kids are changing. So that's a whole nother shift that we're trying to keep up with, like who's coming in now because they're going to be here 5 years from now. You know, it's I'm coming up on that era where I've been out almost 10 years now. there's still people active in the unit I was in that are in leadership positions, but it's getting to a point where I'm going to be that old guy if I go back once a year for the reunion. And people are like, who is that? I would look and be like, who's that? I don't know. Old guy, get out of here. You know, the new kids are in town.
I'd love to comment on that because I've seen a shift just in the 6 years that I've worked in special operations. And when we just spoke at the Green Beret, it was so encouraging because the instructors stood up and they shared stories about how, you know, one guy saying, and he's the toughest guy in the room, you know, he's the guy who everybody kind of fears.
And he's not that bravado guy. He's not that, I did this and did that. He was just telling a story. Mm-hmm. You know?
And it was so encouraging because he talked about how he would cry every day when he came into work. He'd have to pull the car over because of the loss of life that he had seen his last two tours in Afghanistan. And after they had a luncheon for Tom and I, the senior commanders and cadre and instructors, and I pulled him aside and I said, you just saved a whole lot of lives in that room today. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, you're going to deploy with them in the next few months to Afghanistan. He said, yes. I said, when these guys see the worst stuff that they've ever seen in their life and they're freaked out about it, now they know who they can go to. They know they can go to you now. They know they can talk to you. They know they can ask you for help. That will save lives.
More from Seymour native Tom Satterley and his wife Jen next. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our conversation with retired Command Sergeant Major Tom Satterley and his wife Jen on the new book and subsequent foundation, All Secure. When we left off, we were talking about Army leadership signing on to the idea of mental health preparedness for soldiers.
Now we have those touch points, and that's what we've been going at. Get the leadership, talk to them, get them to admit it in front of their people. It's okay. We spoke to SEAL team. I don't know. It ended up being a lot of teams. And their commander was up there. He's like, exactly what we needed, exactly what we needed to hear. I'm glad you said it because I was wagging my finger at those young kids. You know, I know what you're doing. You run around chasing women. You're warriors. You do what you do. You drink. You work out. You know, you can do it. I get it. You're destroying your lives, though. I'm telling you that right now. And the command, you know, and then your friends are going to get injured and killed, and you're gonna think about it, and it's going to destroy you unless you handle it. And the commander pulled aside. He goes, I'm so glad you said that. They needed to hear it. And Jen asked him, well, you know, he's told a story, right, about someone who got hurt or whatever. You want to go ahead and
killed.
Share that? Yeah.
We had worked with this commander a few times during realistic military training, and he was actually one of the commanders I had talked to that they had lost four members in their team. And we had trained with them a whole lot, and I think that was kind of my end of this game. You know, I told Tom, I said, I'm just way too much of a softy and empath to be in this world, and I respect people that can show up and fight and volunteer for this. But he, you know, he had said, I was on the phone with him for 2 hours, kind of talking him through some things. And I said, what are you doing for the guys? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, they just lost four of their brothers. What are you doing? What kind of talks are you having? What kind of help or resources? He says, we don't do that. And I said, why not? This is where if we have 22 veterans that are killing themselves every day, that number is not even accurate, probably closer to 30. Special operations tripled in suicides in 2018. This is part of the problem, and you could be part of the solution.
Yeah, we tell them, we call the leaders out. If you're going to be a leader, be a leader. Do the right thing. And I told all those kids, I go, if you're doing what's legally, morally, and ethically right, you're still going to come home crushed. All right? Don't add to that. Don't go over and think you're untouchable. You can do what you want. Stay within the law, land warfare. I know, you know, you're going to have those feelings of revenge and guys come home and it destroys them, the things that they do. Some of the things guys come talk to me and they're considering, I don't know if that was right or wrong. I was angry, but, you know, it's gone now, right? It's gone. Start to heal. Start to get over it. Start to forgive yourself and get over it because nasty things happen. But I tell them, stay within those lanes. Stay within those lanes. And you can always come out ahead. You can always recover from that. But the difference in the leadership, you know, I can't do that. It's, you know, we can't admit weakness. And then now the leadership standing up telling them, hey, if you self-assess and come and tell me you need help, nothing will happen to you. You won't be removed or moved anywhere else. We'll take care of you until the time's right, and then we'll get you back in the game. But don't get a DUI and then come tell me you got PTS. Don't chase women or don't do anything stupid or cuss out your commander and then say, well, I have PTS. You have to self-assess first. You can't use it as an excuse.
To your point, when you asked if there was any resistance about it shaping the warfighter or making the warfighter softer, Tom has a great story about, you know, the amount of pills that they're given. When I met Tom, he was taking 16 uppers, downers, things to sleep, things for acid reflux, all the things that kind of biologically happen in war are being treated with, you know, this pill and then four to combat the side effects of that pill. So, you know, when you are sharp and you are dealing with the emotional and mental side of war and you're facing it, you are a better warfighter. You're sharper. When the guys who are really messed up and they're using pills and alcohol to cope, that's not the person you want on the battlefield with you. And so we talk about that as well. If you want to be a warfighter that's sharp and on the top of your game, you can't just worry about your muscles, you know, or being a great shooter. You have to worry about and think about the mental game of it and how you're addressing that.
I want to kind of go back to the beginning of your story. The biggest change in your life, which came, was it 6 years ago, 2013?
It was 13.
And it was kind of the rock bottom that got you to where you are today, which what you do today is helping to heal these invisible wounds that servicemen and women face. So what happened in August of 2013?
Ohio, huh? Yeah, what happened, I guess? I don't know exactly what happened other than it was the final culmination of everything I'd been hiding. And we were training, and it was at Canton or Akron. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Somewhere. We've been all over it.
And I had two of my friends in the car. We were driving back to the hotel, and we had been doing that for days and days, and head back, grab some booze and maybe food, and go to bed and wake up and do it all over again. And we drove back that day, and I don't know anything particularly bad about that day. Jen might remember more about that day, but I just was off towards the second half of the day. I just wasn't feeling it. Maybe, you know, I remember thinking, I'll be all right when I start drinking again. You know, it's wake up with a hangover, I'll never drink again. About 2 o'clock, you're like, man, I can't wait to get a drink. And that was my normal. But that day, I was thinking about more. And when we stopped, everybody got out of the car like normal, and they were like, are you coming? And I just sat there, and I'm like, oh, I got a phone call or something. I made some excuse, and I'll follow you in later. And I remember Jim looking back, and my buddy taking off, Teddy, and Rob taking off, and sorry, I'll see you in the bar, you know. They're observant. But Jen was observant, and we talk about it later. She noticed something more than me even. And so I sat in the car when they walked away, and I grabbed my pistol out and charged it and just sat there with on my lap thinking, you know, I remember thinking a couple of things. I feel sorry for the rental car company for having to clean this up. And I remember thinking, do I put it in my head or my mouth? You know, that thought back and forth, I don't want to screw this up. I remember thinking about the stories I've read about people who try to shoot themselves with a shotgun, and the pressure blows your head away before the bullet hits you, so you just maim yourself. So I'm going through this process of how to do it right. And then my phone starts vibrating, and then it continues to vibrate. And I don't know how many times I finally picked it up, and it was like, all I saw was you're late. And I snapped back into, I didn't never want to be late for anything. I had another mission to be on. So I cleared my weapon, put it back in my bag, and stormed on in like nothing ever happened. And I didn't even tell her about it for two months, maybe more, that I remember. And we just sat in a corner that night. She knew I was off, and that's why she was texting me. And we kind of sat and talked by ourselves that night in the bar. But it came on so quick, it's scary. And it was so clear and so easy to do that when I think about it now, I get scared. Like, it scares me how close I really was, because I used to hear stories. I'm like, you didn't do it, so you suck. You suck at what you tried. You know, I used to make jokes like that. Do it, you know, good luck, better next time, you know. And just on the way here, we were on the phone talking to a dear friend of ours, Daryl, from the unit, whose son shot himself, who was a medic in the Army, shot himself
December 18th, I think he was 21 years old after his second
He came
tour.
Home on leave, second tour.
Just saw too much.
Went out on the front porch at his parents' house. He was visiting them and shot himself. And Daryl had to run out there. And they thought he was a suspect right away because of his detachment. He went back to combat mode and was doing CPR triage on his own son, knowing it wasn't going to work. And they were like, "What's wrong with you, man? We thought you were the man because until we found out you were his father because you didn't even seem like you cared." And he goes, I was working. You know, I was working. To find out that he almost took his own life today. And then another close friend of mine from the unit.
Two more
that just recently and just found out today had talked about and almost taken their own life. And I thought, and we've always known, but it hits home when, okay, 22 to 30 a day actually kill themselves. That's crazy. But out of the 22,800,000 veterans alive today, how many of those people haven't done it yet? But how many are tormented and think about doing it? How many people are living in misery and in miserable lives, depressed, that just haven't done it? That number is massive. And to hear it reiterate today about this person, that person, I'm like, that guy? Oh, my gosh. Every time it's a shock, but really it shouldn't be. It's the strong, silent ones that just do it. And everybody's like, oh, my God, I had no idea. You know, the ones that reach out, you can help them. And sometimes people eventually do it. I think a lot of that's out of embarrassment and it's just repetitive. And then a loss of hope. And you keep going deeper and deeper until you finally do it. And I'm so glad I found somebody as patient and comforting as Jen. Because it could have been someone else. And I'm a stubborn person. And what we figured out is the most elite warriors are trained to fix problems, if not take them out. And if that problem is you and you've tried and tried and tried and you can't get better, then you just take yourself out. It's just what you do. That's your job. And it's that cavalier attitude that we're trying to break in people that it's not really your job to do that. You know, you can change and be happy. It's okay. It's what you fought for. Why not deserve some of it yourself now?
Have you had to completely give up the occasional beer, things like that?
No,
so it's not a total sobriety transformation.
Yeah, no. We will drink with our friends, sometimes too many, but not every night. I mean, I was literally every night. And it was just to feel or to cover it up. I'm not sure. Probably a little of both, and it depended on the night. But, I mean, now, no. You know, people treat us that way because we're so much better now. And they equate it with sobriety, which is great. That'd be great, too. But, no, it's all about management. For us, it's about realizing when to quit, when to stop, when is enough, you know. And then I actually studied alcohol effects on the body. So I know that chasing that feeling of good stops at 2 or 3. The rest of the night, you're just chasing that feeling. And it's never going to get better. And then the next day is worse. So, okay, we've set little rules and examples. One drink, one water, two waters, whatever. We set a limit. We stick to it. And we drive on and we feel so much better and we can talk about it and help people because that's such the problem. What's the percentage, hon, of suicides, domestic
89%.
Abuse and alcohol?
So 89% of veterans that are committing suicide are under the influence of alcohol or pills. Mm-hmm. So we know that, you know, when we talk to someone calls for help, it's one of the first questions I ask is how much do you drink? It's not a judgment, and I'll say that. This is not a judgment question. This is just I'm trying to help you get to the point of realizing that you can't go over the edge with alcohol, with PTS. You can't take it. You know, so many of these guys are adrenaline junkies, especially when you get to the point of Delta Force or an elite unit where your body searches and looks for that adrenaline. And so, you know, Tom has had a friend in the last few years that died base jumping. You know, he's got another friend who
at night.
At night, you know, jumping off a tower. He's got another friend who took a paddleboard from New Orleans in open water all the way up to New York. He holds the record for that. You know, another friend that's done extreme mountain climbing. And I mean, everything is kind of around this.
Another one has won the Baja 5000
twice
on a motorcycle.
2 years in a row. And,
you know, his fingernails falling off. He's riding on alone.
Chasing adrenaline.
In the desert, yes. Chasing it, and his fingernails falling off, loving it, and doing it again the next year. And it's just.
But that pedal to the metal, if you'd say, that kind of pushing the limits, that risk is part of PTS. And we talk about that. That looking for that thrill that people will look for it in many different ways. But alcohol is a really dangerous way to do that because it's not – Tom wouldn't have – okay, I'll have a drink or two. Tom would have 11 or 12. You know, and it was being matched in the room by everyone else. So it wasn't like, oh, my gosh, look at Tom. I was like, oh, my gosh, look at everybody. Like everyone in this room, everyone in this group – is going to push the envelope as far as they can, whether it's pills or booze or any kind of adrenaline fix. So,
and it's always worse when they're together.
Yeah.
They may not drink like that with their families or other friends, you know, but together, it's an excuse. And when you have that many people you can drink to that are dead that you know, every other day is a day you can toast, you know, or something, or another night or another capture, another mission that you can celebrate with alcohol. Yeah. So trying to bring awareness to that problem. 89%. If we could take out 89% of suicides by alcohol and drugs, you know, it's just management, really.
I want to close by talking about the All Secure Foundation and the work that you do. So can you kind of describe a typical program process that you'll go through with a family or a service member?
Absolutely. Yeah. So initially we started as a resource library when we very first started All Secure Foundation. Again, Tom and I had a hard time finding resources for help. The more research that we did, and then I would say, Tom, okay, we're going to go do transcendental meditation. Okay, now we're going to go do nutritional supplements. Okay, now we're going to do TMS. And
things I've never heard of. You know, in the military, it's like, here's a Motrin. Get
right.
at it, you know, keep going.
So, yeah, that was a big part of it was let's get the resources out there so people can find ways to help and heal. And then really working in special operations, I started asking the guys, where do you need help? Do you want it, you know, with alcohol? Do you need it with substance abuse? Or do you need it with health and nutrition or family? And 9 times out of 10, somebody would say, I really need help with my relationship at home.
They're all pretty good self-assessors.
Yeah.
Based on their jobs. So they know I need to stop drinking. I know I need to work out. I know I need to eat healthy. I need help with my family. You know, that's what I'm afraid of.
And probably 9 times out of 10, the guys I work with and say I'd rather go back to combat than be at home with my 2-year-old and 6-year-old because I don't know what to do with them. You know, I don't know how to relate to them. And I get really frustrated and angry. So part of what we've done in 2019 is create a program for spouses or couples to come together. So like Tom said, we have a retreat workshop. It's led by a trauma and marriage therapist. So it's 3 days of intensive activities, information, triggers, so that people can begin that path to healing. And in 2020, we've just added 6 more of those. And hopefully in 2021, we can start expanding programming into children.
We expanded to active duty as well for 2020. So,
yeah,
growing
we're doing
fast.
A lot of base work and starting to work with family readiness, to work with spouses and families on awareness and resources as well.
We've been speaking with retired Command Sergeant Major Tom Satterley and his wife, Jen. I want to thank you both so much for coming and being on All In. And for the work that you're doing. Thanks, Tom.
No, we appreciate it. We're definitely all in. Thanks you for having us on here and getting the word out.
Thanks, Jen.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
The book is All Secure, A Delta Force Operator's Fight to Survive on the Battlefield and the Home Front, and it's out now. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts. We're taking a break from new shows for a few days, but we will be back with a new Friday pitch-in at the end of this week. In the meantime, find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. Happy Hanukkah. Merry Christmas. This is All In.